This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome back to the Premed Podcast. Apologies for the delay in this episode. Loyal fans and regular listeners will know that there's been a significant delay in publishing this episode. We've just not put anything out for about 6 months. And that's because both Johnny and I have had quite significant, albeit positive, life events, which has distracted us from recording any episodes. So apologies for that. I have, however, recently had the time to speak with Tom Borum, an NQP and Army Reservist paramedic, about his life in both the NHS and the Army Reserves, believe it or not. But before that, let me tell you a bit about our current pre-med learning products. So some of you will have noticed from our social media or email newsletters that we've moved, or we're in the process of moving, all of our education courses, or most of them, onto an online learning platform. We've recently published 2 modules from our pre-hospital and emergency department ECG course. The first is FedEx ECG Essentials, and this is designed to give learners the fundamental knowledge of the ECG, from cardiac physiology to electrophysiology to the basics of interpretation. The next module, level 1, ensures learners have a comprehensive understanding of 12-bit ECG's fundamentals, can systematically identify a normal sinus rhythm, and can recognise common life-threatening problems. All of our e-learning modules are available on phone, tablet or platform, being cloud-based. You can access them whenever you want, stop them whenever you want, and it will save your progress. And on completion of the course and the associated MCQ assessment, they generate a certificate of completion, which is valid for 1 year, the perfect addition to your CPD portfolio. Additionally, in terms of our prompt cards, we've got a Christmas bundle at the moment. So do head to our Etsy store or our website to see what bundle discounts you can get with our prompt cards during the Christmas season. And all our e-learning and the link to our Etsy store is available, of course, at www.prem-ed.com. And so that's it for advertising. As I've said, I'm going to be talking to Tom Borum, so let's get started with the episode. We had a good chat about the route of entry for paramedics, direct versus in-service, working in the NHS versus the Army Reserves, obviously the impending strike action, as well as mental ill health in the ambulance service and coping strategies, and a bit more thrown in as well. Due to the length of the episode, I've split it into 2, but I'll be publishing the second half in the next few days, so there won't be long to wait. But let's get into the first episode. I hope you enjoy it. Cheers. So, hello. Tom, welcome to the Pre-Med Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
No, thanks for joining me. Thanks for joining me. It's obviously been a while since we've... well, not obviously. You might not have listened, although you tell me you have.
Yeah, but I've avid listener. Listen to them all.
Legend, 50% of our sad, really. Listenership. Yeah, it's been a while since we've done a podcast, and Johnny's not here for reasons I've obviously explained in the intro. So
probably a bit more bantery and enjoyable without Johnny here. But yeah, thanks for coming on. We're basically going to have a bit of a chat about your work and career so far in medicine or pre-hospital care or whatever, if that's all right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So are you all right to tell the listeners a bit about yourself?
Yes. So I'm Tom. I'm a newly qualified paramedic. I've been qualified now for 18 months to and fro. I'm an army reservist as well and an avid rugby player.
Nice.
Not that any of those three things mix, but...
I don't know, army? Yeah. Army, navy, rugby? No?
Yeah, they do like a bit, to be fair. But...
Yeah, fair. Nice. So how long have you been qualified again?
18 months.
18 months.
Yeah, I had a bit of a weird route into it where during...
Tell us about that.
Well, during COVID, the trust that I worked for, I think they... It felt like they panic hired a lot of student paramedics.
Sounds unlike a public trust.
So, because I had my C1 licence, they employed me as an emergency care support worker
on
a bank contract. So I had 18 months being an ECSW before I qualified, which is pretty decent. Really enjoyed that.
Do you think that's a good way of doing it? Because there's obviously the graduate entry route, which is what we both did. And I didn't do any of that. But then there's the... What do you call it? Direct entry? No. Yeah. Whatever it is, that where you work your way up. And it sounds like you did something.
Yeah, it was like a hybrid of the both, working. So I was a student paramedic turning up to shifts to third man. And then the next day I'd wear trust uniform, come into work and be a crewmate for a paramedic. So it was like the best of both worlds in the sense that I got the dynamic of working in a crew, but I could still be a student.
So I think that's what you miss doing the direct entry route, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's... Sometimes being on an ambulance job is you don't need three people.
No.
And you become supernumerary and then you don't get involved so much and things like that. Whereas
yeah, and always find crew, it's really obvious that you're a student as a direct entry because you're stood there and you normally got either if someone's like quite a decent mentor, they'll just stand back and let you do stuff. But even then it's fairly obvious that someone's standing back.
Yeah.
And then you get those mentors that are like, oh, this is the student. They're going to do the student thing while we all watch. And
Yeah,
nice. So good balance then. How long were you in ECSW before you qualified?
It was about 18 months again. So
yeah, nice.
Decent. And I think what it did do is it meant that when I transitioned from student to paramedic, I was... Like, it wasn't a new job. Like, it wasn't like I was having to learn to drive an ambulance again.
Yeah.
I didn't have to learn to do the timesheets. I didn't have to learn how the email works. It was like, it was just a change of epaulets rather than a...
Yeah. And then I guess you can concentrate on learning to be a paramedic.
Yeah,
or learning to put it into practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. So, and then, so you've been qualified for 18 months. How was it, or how's that been? Because there's, you're a paramedic. But the most trusts now do this newly qualified paramedic thing, don't they?
Yeah. Yes.
And so how long you got to do a portfolio and stuff? How long does that last for?
Yeah, so it's a 2-year preceptorship. Straight out of university, then you have 6 weeks with a band 6 paramedic, so experienced paramedic. And then you're given a portfolio to complete by the trust. And then you're supported through the next 2 years until you get your band 6 and become experienced and you get a bit more responsibility. I think it works well. It can be a bit frustrating at times.
In what sense?
Before you're band 6 and you're a band 5 paramedic, you need to have a supported discharge, a shared decision.
Clinician.
And sometimes any clinician can disagree with another for any reason. Sometimes you just feel frustrated that you're left on your own a bit. But you can see why they do it, and like it's definitely, I've learned from the senior clinicians around me who have taught me. And
by having to have that conversation.
And share decision.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Do you have to, isn't there some situations where you don't have to, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's like self-limiting conditions, such as like falls out with no injuries and things like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I always speak to someone anyway, because I feel like it's just being a good clinician.
Yeah, I think it's a sensible thing, isn't it? But it's an interesting one, those conversations, because you can make them go either way, can't you? Like, I mean, I do the same thing. If I'm not sure about something, I'll share the decision with someone else. And I always find this a bit of a weird one, because if you're like seeking permission for something, if you're like truly sharing a decision, you just kind of put something out there and then ask someone's opinion on it, or if you're trying to seek permission for something, you basically just sell them something to say yes to. No, I'm not suggesting you do, but you can't you?
Yeah. It's
a bit kind of, what's the point?
Yeah, sometimes it's a really easy decision and you feel like you're going really well and then you think you're going to sell it really well and then suddenly I don't think it comes out of your mouth properly and then suddenly you got someone down the phone going, no, I don't want you to do that.
Yeah.
But it's good. I mean, what it does is it gets you in the habit of maybe when you don't have to call someone, you still want to.
Because
having the shared decision is obviously good for patients and good for their outcomes as well.
Yeah, and I think also considering that, like it's a big thing in critical care about, you know, often we do like consultant calls and stuff for interventions. And I think it's good to have it, even if you get into the habit of considering it. Because sometimes you're like, oh, maybe I won't. There's for us, there's strict criteria when you have to call and when you don't have to call. But then whenever you, if you don't have to call, there's always the option to do that.
Yeah.
And I think it's good to build in, like you say, build into your practice the consideration that, like, is it worth talking to someone else about this? Because sometimes it's just a complicated situation. It's helpful.
Yeah. And a decision shared is like a risk halved in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's a good way of thinking about it.
Really good saying, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Well done. Glad we recorded that. that is true. What about I mean, obviously you have to kind of do shared decision making for discharges. What about for conveyance to hospital?
No, so I think if you want to convey, I think you're left to make that decision by yourself. And sometimes if it's a really obvious this patient needs to go to hospital, which they often are, then you just take them to hospital and
Do you find you call up? Like, when, if you're thinking this person should go to hospital, do you find that you call up to share that decision sometimes? Because I always think, like, I've got friends that work in, you know, like specialist paramedic colleagues and friends that are on the other end of those calls. And whenever we talk about them, we're like, there's obviously a risk leaving someone at home or, like, discharging someone in the community. But I think the way, like, the NHS is now, some of the patients that we see, there's an inherent risk with conveying people to hospital. But yeah. That risk doesn't seem to be mitigated by any sort of policy.
No, I think it's still considered the safest way. The safest route is probably to take them to hospital.
But do you consider it the safest
route? I do not. I'm not at all. Not at the moment when you've got some 90-year-old who is quite frail. And for an upset tummy, for example, you could argue that 10 years ago the safest thing was to take them to hospital and
have
blood, CT, whatever. But now it's probably not the safest thing because of all the bugs going around.
Yeah.
And the fact they might be left in a corridor for
12 hours. So do you find you share those decisions or not so much?
I do often with the, like, with community hospital avoidance teams and things like that. I think they're wicked. And
that's quite a good setup where you work, is it not?
Yeah, it is. We've got a really good, really good system here. And
they've
started to recognise my voice and number when I pop up. So. I do use them a lot, and obviously the population that we go to around here are quite elderly.
Yeah.
So we do see a lot of them, and I think COVID kind of made them spring up into their own, and they obviously have a really good identity for themselves, and then are wicked. Maybe one I do kind of want to work there one day. But
And it's one of them, isn't it? Like. I think the other thing with COVID is we all kind of had to learn, like pre-hospital people had to learn a lot more about like A&E hospital pathways and things. And, you know, if you can, because as you say, like 10 years ago, maybe you could just go to A&E, be quickly triaged, whereas now you can't, they're so stretched. In fact, one of our local hospitals the other day, you know, I went in there and they had one nurse looking after 80 patients.
That's bonkers.
It's insane, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's absolutely mental. And so you think, like, there's a bit of a responsibility to relieve the burden on that service. But also, as you say, if a patient's going to wait, like, a day for a chest x-ray or, you know, like, an ECG and some bloods.
Yes.
If you can use a pathway for, like, a chest pain clinic or something. Yeah, it's pretty decent.
Something that stuck with me that a paediatric nurse told me the other day is that they know if an ambulance brings a paediatric patient in, that they're not ill. So...
I've definitely ventilated children in hospital.
But you kind of walk into peas now and they roll their eyes and they think, oh god, what's wrong with this one? They'd say if you guys bring them in, they're fine. If the parents bring them in, they're not.
Yeah. Definitely take that with a pinch of salt. But I guess, where do you think that comes from? Because there's most ambulance services now have a policy of mandatory conveyance, don't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, the one I work for is under 2 years old.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I think, the policy must have come from somewhere. I think there's a few serious incidents of non-conveyed children. And I suppose we don't really know that much about assessing children.
Yeah, it's not. Because of COVID, I missed my paediatric placement. Yeah, so all I've learned is from PowerPoints and being on the road.
Yeah. That's nuts, isn't it? So you've not done any paediatric?
No, I never went to A&E and did paediatrics.
Yeah.
All learnt from a textbook.
Yeah.
And my mentors and things like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I think, certainly, like, if you take, I mean, it's the same with adults, isn't it? Well, most of the time. But if you take children to hospital, you know they're going to get seen by a nurse and a generally paediatrician.
Yeah.
Some sort of A&E doctor. So they're going to get a decent assessment.
Yeah.
But then I think that's fine if they call for a medical problem. But I've been to quite a few patients where, you know, like, I went to someone recently who, there's like a language barrier. The mum was a refugee and she didn't really understand the system. There's a language barrier. And so obviously didn't know who to call and basically called 99 for advice on, like, she wanted to talk to a doctor basically.
Yeah.
About, I can't remember what it was, like the kid had like missed a feed or something. You know, it's not a medical problem, it's a social problem.
Yeah.
So then you kind of think that makes it difficult.
Yeah.
The shared decision thing, can you non-convey a child then, or like discharge a child?
I have done in the past where it's like, it's a similar miscommunication with a 909, like, and then they've got nothing wrong with them. If you speak to a senior colleague and say, look, I know this, the policy says, but this is what we've actually got, and I still think it would be not in the patient's best interest.
Yeah.
Often you'd have to take things into account, like, are the mum and dad rational and easygoing?
Yeah, yeah.
Or are they
known to social services?
Known to social services. Is that child, does that child need to be fed at the bottom line? But
Yeah, fair. So the policy doesn't allow for that for you?
No, it shouldn't do, but there is, like, I think there must be extenuating circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
Surely.
Yeah, fair. Fine. So so NQP stuff. So you didn't you have to do this portfolio. Have you done it all?
I have actually.
Have you actually?
Pretty much
everyone I talk to is on 1%.
No, I got into a bit of a competition with my colleagues at work. And
how's it?
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure I've got some kind of ADHD, so I just hated knowing it was outstanding. So I just smashed it out, yeah.
Do you, like, what do you have to do for it?
Oh, it was probably more work than my degree. There's a lot of content you have to do, and they got all these learning points.
So I qualify before you have to do that, and for me, I find it weird that you've just shown them that you've done 3 years of studying.
Yeah.
So do you have to, like, repeat academic stuff, or what is it you have to?
Yeah. So I think it was like up to like 90 odd learning criteria, and you have to prove that you've met them. So some of them are like, show evidence that you complete a mental state examination, which.
How do you evidence that?
So what is a mental state examination? And then often you end up submitting one bit of work and then they bounce it back because you didn't, because the question meant something else.
Right.
So you have to chop and change, constantly go back and forth.
And do you have to, like, write essays or reflections or something?
Cause yeah.
I'm sure I was talking to someone that basically said they just, after a job, they just do a voice note.
Yeah, that's the easiest way I found to do it.
You can do that.
Just do a voice note, and like you and me are sitting here now, you can get someone to ask you the question.
Yeah.
You just say it out loud and then just submit the voice note.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it was.
That's quite good.
When the clinical education told me you could do that. Yeah.
Game changer.
Or you can do, I didn't realise you could do like more than one point in one essay.
You can meet
more than one criteria in one essay. Because I'd be like, write an essay for one point. But then I could have like,
can you do the entire thing in one job?
Yeah, one whole. But you can submit like your patient record forms.
How is that?
Like redacted, obviously, but you can submit them as long as it showed evidence.
Yeah.
So I think one of them was like a capacity assessment, and I was like, just ticked yes for a patient that did have capacity, and it was showing that I could do it even though it was hardly.
Yeah, nice.
Hardly difficult. But yeah, no. It's good to have it done. I don't know if it's made me a better clinician.
No.
But it's nice to have it done.
And you earn more money as a result.
More money, yeah.
It's always good.
That's the main reason, isn't it? But
and so you, not long until you are an experienced paramedic officially, and then how do things change apart from the down to that portfolio? And presumably there's more like discharge and rights and stuff. Is there much other difference between being an NQP and an experienced paramedic?
I think there's not really. I think you've got a few more courses open to you. Like you can do your swamp course.
Okay, what's like that for the crowd?
Can't remember what it stands for. But it's
special weapons and something.
Yeah, I remember. It's something to do with small wounds. Small wounds?
Something sort of close.
Something management.
Fine, yeah. So have you thought about what you want to do career-wise?
Yeah, so I'm lucky that on my station there's hearts. Yes. Hanging around looking really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Special forces.
Do they look cool?
Well, I don't know. They do look pretty.
They're definitely hanging around.
Not when they're playing ping pong in the garage looking for a job to do.
Yeah.
But I see them and I see that they're what their capabilities are, and that's always kind of excited me. I remember before I started the course, just after I'd applied to university, watching all the ambulance programs on the telly, and had their own little special one, didn't they? And I thought, oh, that's a bit of me. Yeah.
And what is it about that? The mixture of like, because they do a lot of fitness stuff, don't they? Which is quite a nice thing to tie into work.
Yeah. It's a bit more, I think they've got quite a lot more problem solving than we sometimes do. They're still obviously clinically trained, kind of jazz, but then they've got to apply it in a more challenging environment.
Yeah, fair.
So that's and kind of.
Do you have to, how many years experience do you have to do that, do you reckon?
I think it's 2 years at band six experience.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. That's changed recently, I think.
That's more than specialist roles, I think.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But, so I've joined SORP.
Oh, yeah? Recently,
which is a bit of a...
So that is special operations response, is it? Which I think
Spec ops,
yeah. That's better than heart. I'm staying SORP, aren't you? What'd you get with that? Envis?
No.
Fair.
No, you don't. No.
Fair. What's SORT then compared to heart?
SORT is it's like a step down SORT will kind of support heart at major events and things like that.
Right.
You have SORT trained paramedics who are working in normal operations, and then heart are kind of kept back as a heart team.
And so because the SORT, some services they're on cars, aren't they?
Yeah.
So as a SORT paramedic, do you work in a car? Are you allowed to work in a car as an NQP?
No, you're not. So SORT was in our trust on cars only.
Right.
And they've recently, the NARU guidelines, which is the National Ambulance Resilience Unit.
You've passed that test, well done.
Just because I've done my course. The NARU have changed the specs recently, and now it's an ambulance-led system. So they want...
Oh, as in like a DCA.
They want a DCA with two crew members that are both SORT trained in... MTA and CBRN.
Yeah. And so, like, in my job, I've done MTA training, and we're supposed to get all this gear.
Yeah.
Like, so, what is MTA? Marauding Terrorist Attack. So we're supposed to have all these, like, bulletproof vests and stuff, and we never got them because they changed the plans that you guys would carry all of this, all of that gear, and then just be at all those jobs.
Yeah.
And do you think that'll work? Because I had a friend who was sort of paramedic, and in fact I've got a few mates that have done it, and pretty much every job that I've heard about, which is like stabbing or shooting, they're like discharging someone in the community, and then they can't go to the job.
I mean, so the system how it's going to work, I think, is so say supermarket blows up, you need heart will be deployed, they'll be ready, and then but you'll have SORT on the road, and we're obviously trained to deal with that as well.
Yeah,
but we don't have our own equipment on us. The idea is that a vehicle with lots of ballistic vests.
Major instance. Who drives that then?
Exactly. So it'll be sitting on a station nearby. Supermarket blows up, and then all the sort heart will go, and all the sort guys and all that equipment will have to. We'll have 10 minutes to break away from whatever we're doing.
Oh, so you can't break.
Which would be very difficult if you're at an arrest or a birth or a. Conveying a patient to a hospital, and then someone on that station where the support vehicle is would have to jump, find the keys, jump in, take it to that place. But there's quite a lot of moving parts quite a lot of moving parts in my opinion. But it's not been tested yet, really, the new system. So
It's always a weird one as well, isn't it? Because I don't know if you know about funding. Do you know about funding? Because like NARU, I mean, I'm not suggesting I do, but my understanding is narrow, like centrally funded, which is why Heart have always got like money to do specialist stuff, because it's like centrally funded in case of terrorist type stuff.
Yeah.
And presumably sort of is the same, but you kind of think financially, those cases are like so few and far between.
Yeah.
Theoretically, you can't justify spending too much money on it. So it's a bit of a weird balance, isn't it? But then in my experience, those jobs always go wrong, normally within about 10 minutes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can understand why they've moved to this system, because these jobs are so too and far between. And if you've got a load of paramedics sitting on cars who can't convey patients to hospital, then you can understand why maybe operations would agree with it. Let's put them on ambulances.
Yeah.
But then if you have an incident like Manchester within the trust, you just got to hope that everything goes well. But you're right, like, you can't organise chaos like that.
Normally. As I understand, hope is not a good plan A or whatever the quote is. Nice. So aim for Heart then. And is that, what is your long-term career plan? You mentioned an interest in the community stuff, but
do you
like specialist paramedic roles or in hospital staff or what?
I don't think I'd ever see myself as a CCP, critical care.
I won't take it personally.
No, I think seeing how good a job you guys do, I'd be much worse. No, I like the practitioner route, paramedic practitioner.
Yeah, fair. So like urgent emergency care, primary care type stuff.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And then I do enjoy like geriatrics.
Yeah,
dealing with the elderly.
Yeah,
I think that's quite
rewarding. And there's a few roles, isn't there? I mean, there's increasingly a lot of roles for advanced clinical practitioners, and quite a few frailty teams now. So would you be interested in doing something like that? Because I always think, I don't know, there's a lot of, in fact, I've looked at a few myself, but like in hospital advanced paramedic routes, and I always, it's a big leap, isn't it? If you spent your entire career in the ambulance service, would you see yourself working in a hospital or in a community team?
Well, I think it's how long, I do often ask myself, how long can I do working in an ambulance for? Because you do get worn down, don't you? But then you bounce back after a few days off, so. But I can't see myself working in the ambulance service for the rest of my life. But
no,
I do enjoy working in healthcare. So
yeah, I think it'd be quite interesting to do. I think it'd be good to do like a mixture of both.
Yeah,
a bit of in and out.
Yeah, to be fair, when I take time away from work with the army,
I do miss
wearing a different shade of green in the ambulance service.
Yeah, that is weird, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know why.
So what's the deal with the army then? So, army reservist, is it?
Yeah, so I'm an army reservist.
And what do you do in that? Because they have a thing about paramedics, don't they? Like the military.
Yeah.
Like it's different for paramedics and nurses. You can't just join as a paramedic.
Yeah, so nurses can either join as a soldier nurse.
Yeah.
Or they can become a professionally qualified officer.
Okay.
So the army will employ them as an officer in a medical role.
Right.
Paramedics, the army's not really got a need for them to be in an officer role.
Right.
They've got like very competent combat medics
who
are trained to the level as a paramedic, or can train to the level as a paramedic.
Yeah.
But have not yet, and they kind of fill that role, pre-hospital role, really well.
Yeah.
They're as well trained as paramedics are in trauma, in my experience.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because I don't think paramedics are very well trained in trauma at all. In fact, like, I do it as a job, and I don't feel particularly confident with trauma.
Yeah,
because you just don't see it, do you? Like,
I'm
helping out with the training at work this year, and as part of it, I teach. We go for like the critical hemorrhage bag, and half of it I've never used before. I've never put on a tourniquet, so I kind of, and then sometimes you get people, like you say, who are ex-military medics, and I'm like, you teach us because I, you know what I mean, and I think I mean, it's like we're talking about with the NQP portfolio and shared decision making stuff, like I think the parents are competent, or like very competent in like an area of out of hospital kind of social medical care kind of stuff, and like the complexities of those decisions, but not in what people think of, like, I mean, we go to cardiac arrest, but that's about it in terms of critical care, isn't it? Unless you're like in that role.
Yeah, it's very. Yeah, I think you tell people you're a paramedic, and they go, "Oh, wow, you must to have seen some things.
Think, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No.
Yeah, since some awful poverty.
Seen some great care homes.
Exactly, yeah. So you can kind of see why it wouldn't fit with a military model, because, and the other thing I think is all of that, like, you don't need like a degree to be able to be taught to function well in terms of like managing trauma care and stuff. It's much more practical teaching, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I guess ultimately you're not making like complex decisions or like patient-centered type decisions.
I think the military is really algorithm-based, and it's really like
dumbed
down, made people, and people follow this SOPs really well. And
yeah.
Like the same way we got our JR Calc, but it's open to interpretation.
Yeah.
The
army
is like set in their ways.
Yeah.
Like, it's an algorithm, you follow it and it's done. And then that, and then you know it's been done up the chain, you know it's going to be done down the chain. So, and it's been proven to work, and and that's why it's used pretty effectively. So,
and so what is the, like, the nurse, if you're a nursing officer, presumably there's an there's a place for nurses, because ultimately, like, nurses work, they're much more managerial than paramedics, aren't they, in terms of, you know, like, if you're a sister in charge of A&E, you're dealing with a lot of moving patients around and referring to different wards and stuff, where we're literally like one person at a time.
Yeah.
Is that what, is that what their role is? Military.
You know what? I can't really comment. I'm pretty sure.
Obviously done your homework.
Yeah. No, but...
So tell me about the paramedic role in the Army Reserve.
Yeah. So the paramedic role is quite similar. As a paramedic soldier, it's quite similar to the one pre-hospital in the NHS.
Okay.
Yeah, they do quite a lot of similar things, but they are still quite algorithm-based.
Yeah.
They might do a bit of urgent care with under a medical officer, which is a doctor.
Right.
So, but they are trained to live as a paramedic, and they do have the registrations, and they can do all the kind of things that...
And do they, like, do they do the combat medical stuff? They more
they do their, like, battles course. Like...
Oh, fair. So is that what you do?
No, so I'm a medical support officer, so I've got... So I'm in a medical unit, but I don't do any patient-facing stuff. So.
Okay. How come you went for that? More salutes.
More salutes, yeah. No. I've got lots of my family have been officers.
Oh, is it?
Past, and I felt like it was a nice change. I thought I'd enjoy the change in pace from being patient-facing to having a non-patient-facing role working
outside of
and making sure that they were two different jobs works quite well.
Yeah,
they do go hand in hand, and like lessons I've learned in one uniform do transfer to the other.
Yeah. So what do you do as a role? So if you're not seeing patients, what is the, you know, what are you expected to do?
So as a MSO, your job is to make sure that anyone clinical is only doing clinical things.
Right.
And they're not being like, and they can put the most of their effort into doing their jobs as clinical patient facing staff. So my job would be like logistics, planning, a bit of HR, things like that. Or an army base, making medical plans for other units, like making sure that they're covered and we're covered. It's quite a complex, as you can imagine, like, it's quite a complex system going from point of wounding on a battlefield all the way back to Birmingham Hospital. So so there's quite a lot to put in place, and working within these algorithms we stated before,
that's, mm-hmm.
we just have to make sure everything's done properly and done effectively.
It sounds quite team leader-y.
It is, it is. And to be fair, I'm hoping that one day might help me within the ambulance service. But
I was going to say,
I mean, I had 8 weeks at the military academy,
Sandhurst,
and that was awesome. That was hard work, but it was awesome. And, you can, like, military leadership and NHS leadership is on completely different planets.
What do you reckon is better?
Might be biased, but really, I think
that's a difficult question in case either of your employees listen to this ever.
I think I'm not ashamed to say I think military leadership. I think the NHS can learn a bit from the military.
Yeah, I agree. Fair. And is that so? The team leader thing. Do you reckon will you apply for team leader?
Yeah, I probably would one day.
I think that'd be a good shout.
I think I do like that, and then it would mix my roles quite well, I think.
Yeah. But,
I think they have a good gig, the ATLs.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah,
no, it's a good job. Have you ever deployed with the army?
No, never. I'm still quite new. I'm only what's called a one pip, second lieutenant.
Okay.
So
that still sounds quite advanced. head to shoulder.
It's not. I think it's very embarrassing. Very embarrassing rack slide to wear. No, it's not. It's no, it's a good role. And
fair.
Junior officers, like we're still the new guys.
Yeah, but, yeah. And how does it work with, like, if you have to deploy, how does that work? Obviously, you're a full-time NHS.
Yeah.
How does that work in terms of your employment, or even in fact with training and stuff? Like, do they allow for that? What?
So, work, my trusts are really good. I get 2 weeks off
extra
for Army Reserve stuff.
Yeah.
And then I can basically have whatever unpaid I want to do Army stuff, which is pretty good.
And then do the Army pay the same amount?
Like, yeah.
If you go and do Army work, do they pay the same wage, or is it?
I think it's about the same, yeah. It's not too bad. But like weekends away, you get like the unsocial pay and things like that. So
okay.
It does add up, yeah. And then every year, I'm going to do a bit of a sales pitch for the reserves. Every year, if you turn up enough, 29 dates.
Bounty.
Yeah, you get your bounty, and that's a big cash of a big cash pile of grand.
Is it?
Yeah every year.
And do you do like training abroad? Like, do you get deployed to do training?
Yeah, they can do. Like, they, you can't really stay idle. There's loads of opportunities in the
army. Yeah.
Like the courses aimed at me and my role are lots of medical management courses.
Yeah.
But if you joined as a paramedic soldier, you could or any role, you could do like be a CBRN instructor and learn how to teach people to put on their gas masks. And then you could be a battles, so pre-hospital trauma life support courses.
Yeah.
Like you could get them, you could be an instructor on that. So there's loads of qualifications. You can do your you can learn Arabic and French and all that, and you'll be paid to do that. So
yeah, fair.
It is a good job. It is a good role and
opens a few doors.
It does, yeah, absolutely.
Did you ever look at joining regulars?
No, never.
Doesn't interest you.
No, it doesn't. It's never. Lots of my friends have joined the regulars.
Yeah.
But it never crossed my mind really. I've always enjoyed the emergency services, and I didn't really know I wanted to join the Army Reserve until I was already in the emergency service.
And what made you go for Army? Is it the family thing, or did you look at other armed forces?
I think I gave a brief look at the RAF MERT.
Yeah,
but I have a medical unit near me.
Yeah,
and they're an Army one, so it made sense to go with them.
So for people who might be interested in that, because I think a few people are interested, do you think you mentioned like it fits quite well with work because they let you do it.
Yeah.
And the fact, I mean, it's probably a bit of a clincher having the base near where you live.
Yeah.
But do you think it fits in with your role life as a normal operational, like NHS paramedic well?
Yeah.
Would you recommend it?
Yeah, I would. I would to anyone who wants to do it. I think just the opportunities it opens up. The people you meet as well.
Yeah.
Like, I've met people who are physios and ODPs that I would never have met otherwise. And when you're wearing the same uniform as them and you're on the same team, it works really well.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can speak to guys who have been doing your job a lot longer than you have.
Yeah.
And it works really well because, again, experience off of them. And it's a change in environment. I think that works big part, like when I'm feeling sick and tired of ambulancing.
Obviously, like a change is as good as a rest is the thing in there. And I always think that, because I do a couple of different, you know, like sometimes work in the control room, and it is nice balance to go and do something else.
Yeah.
And you know, like if I do overtime on a DCA, as like in operations, one day of that makes me remember how enjoyable my job is, because it's so stressful.
Yeah.
And I think, it's a good balance, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd recommend it to anyone who wants to.
Yeah, fair.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.